Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, July 13, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call, Taking Private Property, Examining the Patent Review Process. Today, we welcome our expert, Professor David Olson at the Boston College Law School. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and note that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. And to introduce today's speakers and the moderator of this call, I'm going to turn it over to Professor Olson. Professor Olson, the floor is yours.
I'm David Olson, professor at Boston College Law School, and it's my pleasure to moderate today's panel on taking private property, examining the patent review process. I'm going to leave the majority of the background to Professor Greg Dolan, but I'll just say briefly that what we're examining are changes in practice that have occurred since the 2011 America Invents Act, and specifically the provisions that were created for inter partes review and post-grant review, although I believe we'll be mostly focusing on inter partes review. Most basically, and in a nutshell, what the law allowed was a process of reviewing patents after they've been granted, after they've been issued. It allows for anyone to bring a challenge to the patent office to argue that the patent should not have been granted, that it's invalid for reason of lack of validity along novelty lines based on documentary evidence or prior patents. This process, although there were processes like this in the past, the process is more robust and gives more tools to the challenger, including a preponderance of the evidence standard for invalidating a patent instead of clear and convincing evidence. Likewise, the interpretation, which the Supreme Court recently, last month, upheld the interpretation of the patent, of the PTO, that the Patent Trial and Appeal Board may determine that the, or may use the broadest reasonable construction standard in determining what a claim means. So what that means is the board can say, okay, what's the broadest reasonable way this patent language would be construed? Let's use that, and we will then decide whether, when using that broadest reasonable language, whether any prior art would have come within that area and therefore invalidate a patent. This has led to a number of patent invalidations. The most recent statistics I could find from the PTO show that nearly 50,000 patent claims have been challenged, and about 11,000 of those claims have been invalidated, or about 23%. So this has had a substantial effect. The Supreme Court recently said that IPR proceedings, decisions to institute them, are non-appealable, and that the PTO has the authority to use this broadest reasonable construction standard. But questions remain about the constitutionality of this system, and specifically Professor Greg Dolan and Professor Irina Manta have a recent article called Taking Patents, arguing that these decisions invalidating patents amount to regulatory takings. So I will let Professor Dolan say more about that. Let me just do some brief introductions of our three distinguished and expert panelists, and then I will turn the conversation over to Professor Dolan. So we're going to start with him. He's Associate Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore. His widely published scholarship centers on patent law with a specific focus on how patent regime affects innovation, especially in biopharmaceutical areas. And his work in these areas includes a number of articles, presentations, amicus briefs, and congressional testimony. Professor Dolan is also co-director of the Center for Medicine and Law, a partnership between the University of Baltimore Law School and Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. Additionally, Professor Dolan is associate director of the Center for Law and Intellectual Property and Technology. Professor Dolan holds a number of advanced degrees, including an MD from Johns Hopkins, JD from Georgetown, Doctor of Medicine, and an MA in Philosophy and Social Policy. After Professor Dolan speaks, Professor Camilla Hurdy, who is currently at the Center for Technology Innovation and Competition, or is the Center for Technology Innovation and Competition Fellow at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, will speak. Professor Hurdy is also a visiting fellow at the Information Society Project at Yale Law School, and starting in the fall, she will be Assistant Professor of Law at the University of Akron School of Law. Her research focuses primarily on patent law, innovation policy, and the intersection between innovation and economic development. She's received various awards for her writing and also has a master's degree in addition to her JD from Berkeley, a master's degree in the history and philosophy of science from the University of Cambridge. In the interest of brevity, I won't describe her, the numerous prestigious journals in which she has published or her law clerking. Last but not least, we have Ben Picozzi, who is a fellow at the Information Society Project at Yale Law School. Ben is a recent graduate of Yale Law School, where he served as articles editor for the Yale Journal of International Law. His interests include patent law and innovation policy. Prior to law school, Ben worked at the International Intellectual Property Institute, a nonprofit organization promoting creative uses of intellectual property in developing countries. And with that, I will turn this over to Professor Greg Dolan to make the case for why inter partes review, post-grant review procedures can amount to regulatory takings.
Thank you, David. Thank you, Federalist Society, for hosting it. Thanks, Camilla and Ben, for joining the panel, as well as putting your response to Irina's and mine paper in writing. It's been a fun time debating in print, and I'm looking forward to doing it today. So David has already laid out some of the background, but let me so quickly recap the legal landscape, which I believe gives rise to a constitutional takings problem. In 2012, when Congress passed the Leahy-Smith American Invents Act, it created a new procedure for challenging patents. Now, it's true that it's always been the case that patents, once issued, were not set in stone. They were always challengeable. But traditionally, the challenge proceeded in Article III courts, where somebody who was being accused of patent infringement, as a defense, could interpose the defense that the patent on which that person or that corporation is being sued is not actually a valid patent. Later on, and I'll touch on it in a minute, there also were created some administrative procedures, but traditionally it was all an Article III adjudication mechanism. And from the earliest days of the Republic, the courts have held that at least once once we move to the examination system of patents, as opposed to mere registration, where the patent was issued after having been examined and sort of taken a look at and judged against prior art by some sort of administrative agency, the courts have really held throughout that in order to invalidate the patent, there must be clear and convincing evidence of its invalidity. It was not enough to show merely by preponderance of evidence that it wasn't valid. The American Invents Act changed that with respect to these new proceedings. In these new proceedings that David briefly described, the patents can't be invalidated by preponderance of the evidence as opposed to by clear and convincing evidence. And again, I'll briefly describe the scope of the new proceedings soon, but that was the one fundamental change. The other change was that for a long time, the Federal Circuit has held and Supreme Court has agreed that once patent issues, its claims, the claims would really describe the invention, that's sort of the meets and bounds of the invention, have to be interpreted in accordance with what a person of ordinary skill in the art would understand. And that makes sense, because after all, patents are written not for the lay public, but patents are documents, legal documents to be sure, but documents nonetheless written for the public that actually understands the relevant field of endeavor. So patents in biochemistry are written for biochemists, patents in pharmaceuticals are written for pharma people, patents in computer science are written for people who understand computer science. They're not written for somebody, computer science patents are not written for somebody like me who doesn't really understand that stuff, and I would not be very good in interpreting them, but a computer scientist will be. What the American Invents Act changed, or actually what the regulations promulgated pursuant to American Invents Act changed, is the way to interpret those patents. So now, instead of looking at what would a reasonable person skilled in the relevant field of the endeavor, what would they understand certain words to mean? Now, the patent office, in trying to adjudicate those patents, looks at what is the broadest reasonable meaning of those claims, even if a reasonable person of skill would understand those claims to be much narrower, because he or she would have enough background both in the patent itself and in this other surrounding literature. And that makes a difference, because the broader the patent claim is, the more likely it is to sweep within its ambit prior art. And once it sweeps into within its ambit prior art, it necessarily becomes invalid. So what happened with the American Invents Act? The American Invents Act created this quasi-judicial proceedings, which are now not held in the Article III courts, but are now held back in the Patent and Trademark Office. But they are, in many respects, like a trial. There is an opposing party who files a petition for review. There is deposition of experts. There is evidence submitted of various prior art. And there is a trial, or at least an oral argument, held before a panel of three administrative patent judges who then issues a written decision. And so in many respects, it's like a trial, but much more abbreviated. It must be completed under AIA within 12 months of beginning. There's some preliminary stage where, you know, PTO actually decides whether or not to, you know, whether or not to begin the trial. But it's a much more abbreviated, much fewer evidence can be submitted. There's much sort of tighter limits on the volume of argument and so on. And it's also cheaper, so it became a favorite tool of challengers to the patent. As Professor Olson mentioned, the invalidation rate is quite high. I think so. The statistics he looked at are actually somewhat I don't want to use the word misleading, but they're actually somewhat more pro-patent than what is actually happening on the ground, because at 50,000 claims being challenged, doesn't take into account that some of them have been settled, some of them, you know, have not yet, decisions have not been made whether or not to institute. But of those claims that are actually instituted, the invalidation rate is somewhere varies between 70 and 80%. So it's actually quite high. So where does the taking come in? If we go back to pre-2012, pre-AIA, once a patent had issued, it had a certain scope. Now, it's true that scope may not have been readily apparent. It may have taken some poring over the patent, some figuring out what exactly those words mean, but we had rules as to how to define those meets and bounds. Either those meets and bounds were clear, or at least we had certain rules to define them. And that was important because that patent was negotiated between the patentee and the public, represented by the Patent and Trademark Office. Patentee gave up certain things in trying to get that patent, probably amended it during the prosecution of the patent, in exchange for a vested right in that property. And Supreme Court has held on numerous occasions, both recently as well as going back to the early 1800s, that patents are indeed a property no different than a patent to own land, which used to be given back when Americans were settling the western part of the country. So a patent in intellectual property is no different, at least for constitutional purposes, than a right to real property. And so these individuals who've gotten these patents pre-2012, they've had a defined property right with specific meets and bounds. Once America Invents Act was passed, and more importantly, once the regulations were promulgated, allowing the Patent Office to construe the claims broader than they were actually agreed upon with the patentee, they have changed the boundaries of a vested property right. Now, if this were real property, we would say, great, the property holder got actually more than he bargained for. He now has actually a bigger piece of land because the boundaries were expanded. The problem is in the patent world, expanded boundaries are just as bad and perhaps even worse than narrow boundaries, because expanded boundaries, as I mentioned before, make it more difficult to defend against invalidity challenges. They sweep within its ambit more prior art. And making matters worse still is that these expanded boundaries are only looked at for the purpose of invalidity. For the purpose of actual infringement, the patentee is stuck with a narrow boundary. So the patentee gets it from both ends. The patentee really gets the worst of both worlds. Narrow boundaries for the purposes of infringement, broad boundaries for the purpose of invalidity. Something that has never sort of been done before. The claims always have meant one thing for all purposes once the patent had been issued. So that, of course, led to the patents being much less valid because they're now much easier to invalidate, being broader. And by some estimates, And I know, Sir Camilla and Ben will discuss that perhaps those estimates are not great and there may be some methodological problems with them, but nonetheless, and we can certainly debate that, but nonetheless, by some estimates, the value of patents, at least in some cases, have dropped by half to two-thirds. And that is a significant, significant drop in the value of patents, again, in these vested property rights. So my argument is simply this. By changing the patent boundaries, what Congress, or rather what PTO did pursuant to congressional authority, is one of two things, and I think both arguments can be easily maintained. One is that what they did is akin to an actual physical taking where the government invaded, much like they would have invaded land and physically occupied it, government invaded the space that used to belong to the patentee and now has changed those boundaries. So the argument is that that would be a per se taking because it is a specific change in boundaries. The alternative argument is that this is a regulatory taking. The government promulgated rules that significantly depressed the values of the patent without any sort of correspondent benefit to the property rights holder. And I mentioned before the difference between standard of proof, and so I'll close the circle by saying that the dumping of the standard of proof from dumping it down from clear and convincing evidence to merely preponderance of evidence, which is now the new standard in these administrative proceedings, exacerbates the problem of boundary changes. So I think the boundary changes are sort of the most important problem, but they really work hand in hand. Lower standard of proof, broader boundaries, boundaries that were not negotiated between the patentee and the PTO, results in the patentee getting something that they did not agree to, and that changing their actual vested property rights. And that, in my view, is taken. And I think I'm a bit over time, so I'll stop here, but I'm happy to answer more questions or engage in a back and forth with my interlocutors.
Great. Thank you, Greg. And to give a differing viewpoint on this, we next have Professor Camilla Hurdy.
Great. Thank you both for your comments. And Greg, I think that was an excellent overview of the system and your arguments. So the subject that Ben and I are going to discuss is twofold. First, I'm going to talk about the issue Greg was just talking about. Did the AIA effectuate a Fifth Amendment taking of patents granted prior to passage of the AIA by making it easier to invalidate them in post-grant review proceedings? And then Ben is going to talk about another issue that has recently come up in challenges, which is whether these post-issuance review proceedings, which obviously occur before an administrative tribunal, whether these are unconstitutional under Article 3 and under the Seventh Amendment. So Ben's going to talk about that. So with respect to the takings issue, okay, so did the AIA effectuate a taking of free AIA patents by beefing up options for invalidating them post-grant? Well, you can certainly see the logic that Professor Dolan laid out here without agreeing with his ultimate position on the takings issue. It's not insane to say that the value of existent patents has fallen due to the fact that they're more vulnerable to invalidation. And even putting aside, you know, the numbers that Professor Dolan cited, a drop in two-thirds, who knows, but certainly it's possible that this value reduction is because of some of the specific practices the PTAB is using in IPRs, whether it's preponderance of the evidence versus clear convincing evidence standard, or whether it's using the broadest reasonable construction standard. Okay, so maybe the value of patents has fallen because of the AIA. But let's step back and put this argument that this is a taking, let's put it in perspective. Saying that the government potentially has to pay patent holders just compensation every time it passes a law that makes it moderately easier to invalidate an issued patent has really big implications. So Professor Dolan is objecting to these new IPR proceedings, but what about judicial actions? What about the Supreme Court's recent decisions making it easier to invalidate software patents under Section 101? Does the government now have to pay patent holders whose patents are less valuable post-Alice? What about the new laws that give targets of bad faith patent assertions the chance to get compensation? This these kinds of laws certainly would reduce the value of some patents owned by PAEs, which that is what some call patent trolls. These patents can no longer be enforced with impunity. Is this a compensable taking? So we need to put this in perspective. And then even limiting our discussion to the changes made by the AIA and the new IPRs and CBMR proceedings, here what Ben and I write in our response is that we think that the case law that Greg mentioned a bit of, that both at the Supreme Court and at the Federal Circuit, just doesn't support that this is a taking. The modern case law doesn't support that this is a taking. So first off, unlike for trade secrets, of course, are privately created, privately held information with economic value. Trade secrets can be taken. The Supreme Court has said that. But the Supreme Court has never actually directly held that patents, which are rights issued by the government itself through an extensive process of administrative review, can be taken by government. So there is some very old dicta and even some recent dicta suggesting as much. So in Horn, a 2015 takings case that Dolan and Manta cite in their article, the Supreme Court held that the Fifth Amendment requires that the government pay just compensation when it takes personal property, just as when it takes real property. And to make that point, in some pretty unnecessary dicta, the court made the analogy to patents, and it quoted an old Supreme Court case from 1882, James v. Campbell, in which the court had said, patents, just like real property, cannot be appropriated or used by government itself without just compensation. Now, not only are both Horn itself and James pure dicta, meaning that the statement was just an analogy, it wasn't necessary to the holding, but subsequent case law and statutory development since the 19th century in the patent law area really cast doubt on the notion that this proposition that patents can be taken under the Fifth Amendment holds weight today. Okay, so I'm not going to disagree with what Professor Dolan said about patents being like property for constitutional purposes. I think the case law seems to be pretty clear. There's been some statements that patents are protected by due process. No one's questioning that. But are they subject to the takings clause? And here, it seems that the case law is weak. So today, unlike in the 19th century, we actually have a specific procedure for compensating patentees when government infringes their patents. Patentees have to go to the Federal Court of Claims pursuant to 28 U.S.C. 1498, where the federal government has waived its sovereign immunity for its own patent infringements. So, for example, if the government uses a patented weapon in wartime, the patentee can ask the government to pay it, but only essentially a reasonable license fee, and only to the extent that sovereign immunity has been waived. And the Federal Circuit in Zoltec made it pretty clear that the patentee's exclusive remedy in that government infringement circumstance is a tort-like patent infringement action, and only to the extent sovereign immunity is actually waived. There is no additional takings claim to make there. But let's concede that the case law on this, for various reasons we can discuss later, does leave a lot of negative space. So what if government doesn't just infringe a patent requiring compensation under 1498? What if government actually passes a law that devalues all patents by slightly altering their scope? And that's what essentially Greg is alleging has happened here, that the AIA reduced the value of any patent issued before the law was passed by making it more likely the patent will be found invalid and therefore valueless. But even here, we think the takings argument has some pretty serious problems. First off, the Federal Circuit itself, in a decision called Patlex, with Judge Newman writing the opinion, actually already rejected a constitutional challenge back in 1980 to the then-new reexamination procedure. The Federal Circuit held that this new reexam option didn't violate the Fifth Amendment, at least under the Due Process Clause. Reexamination, Judge Newman wrote, was merely a curative designed to cure defects in the patent issuance process. It wasn't some kind of unreasonable interference with private rights. So even though that wasn't necessarily a takings analysis, similar reasoning may well apply here. The second weakness is really is just modern takings doctrine itself. So under the current test, at minimum, the patentees would have to show first that there's been an economic impact devaluing their patents because of specific changes made by the AIA, and this will be, I think, quite difficult. And second, they would have to show that their reasonable investment-backed expectations were violated. And here I ask, was any reasonable patentee really that surprised when Congress beefed up the post-grant review options? Congress had been tweaking these proceedings for 30 years. Many attributes of the new IPRs and the new CBMRs, including broadest reasonable construction, were already being used in some form. And if we look at the general regulatory background, Congress makes patents less valuable all the time. Take pharma patents. Does government have to compensate patentees every time it passes a law making it easier for the FDA to delay entry of a patented drug into the marketplace that may reduce the value of the patent but doesn't necessarily require compensation? So to a large degree, patentees to some extent have to put up with this kind of regulatory scheme in which patents are granted and in which they operate in the marketplace. So that's our starting argument on the takings issue, and I'm now going to pass it to Ben Bacozzi to discuss the Article 3 issue.
Thank you. As Camilla mentioned, I'll be addressing a related series of constitutional issues to those discussed by Greg and Camilla, but don't directly pertain to the Fifth Amendment takings claim. Recently, plaintiffs in two cases, MCM Portfolio and Cooper, have challenged the constitutionality of inter partes review and other administrative validity proceedings on Article 3 and 7th Amendment grounds. In short, the plaintiffs in these cases argue that these proceedings are unconstitutional because they are essentially judicial proceedings, which should be held in Article 3 courts rather than non-Article 3 tribunals like the Patent Trial and Appeal Board. Petitions for certiorari are currently pending in both cases, and we should learn whether the Supreme Court decides to hear them at the beginning of next term. During these brief opening remarks, I'd like to discuss why these challenges are interesting, both from the perspective of those interested in patent law and to conservatives generally, and then explain why, at least in my opinion, it would be relatively easy for the court to deny certiorari or rule against the petitioners in these cases. So why are these cases interesting? Well, first, MCM and Cooper provide an opportunity for the court to clarify the boundaries of the public rights doctrine. Now, under that doctrine, non-Article III tribunals may hear certain matters that involve public rights, such as those created by the federal government, or those that are closely integrated with the federal statutory scheme. And in MCM, the Federal Circuit relied on this doctrine to uphold the constitutionality of inter partes review. Currently, the Supreme Court is sharply divided over how strongly Article III's requirements should be read, largely along partisan lines. On the one hand, liberals favor more non-Article III adjudication, while on the other, the conservatives are more reluctant to allow this. And as an aside, the current partisan battle lines haven't always been drawn in this particular fashion. The debate over Article III has shifted over time, and at certain historical moments, conservatives have favored more non-Article III adjudication, and liberals have favored the opposite. Additionally, and most relevant to those of us interested in patent law, MCM and Cooper provide an opportunity for the court to clarify how the public rights doctrine interacts with the court's historical patent precedents, which Greg alluded to. The petitioners in these cases rely heavily on the court's 19th and early 20th century patent cases, cases that predate the rise of the administrative state, and the court hasn't yet decided how those cases should be read in light of its more recent precedents involving administrative adjudication. Now, these issues aside, I think it would be relatively easy for the court to deny cert or rule against the petitioners. The first reason for this is that MCM and Cooper are hurt by bad facts. In both cases, the PTAB found that the challenged patents were invalid, and as we recently saw in Quozo, the court's perceptions regarding the quality of the patents at issue can have a significant influence on the direction of oral argument and perhaps on the court's ultimate decision. Additionally, as I alluded to earlier, the court would certainly decide, or at least could certainly decide, that its more recent public rights cases supersede any 19th and early 20th century cases involving patents which form the basis for the challenge, that there's just simply too much constitutional water under the bridge for this challenge to be viable. And finally, IPR proceedings are very difficult to distinguish from other kinds of administrative adjudication, including those that unquestionably involve private property such as money. And so the court might worry that if it sides with the petitioners in these cases, it will upset administrative lawmaking more generally. And with that, I'd like to turn over this discussion back to the other discussants and see where we can go from here.
Okay, thank you
so
very
if
much.
You would, if you would permit me just a couple of moments to respond mostly to Pikla, because I think she makes some excellent points. And in response, I'll just say a couple of things. So, no, I don't think that any change in law that affects the value of the patent is compensable, just like not every change in law that affects the value of the property is compensable. So, for example, because the government decides to build a DMV in the next block over, and now my block is more trafficked, that might depress the value of my house, but I don't think that's a compensable taking merely because I've lost the value of the property. The problem for me comes in not so much in the loss of value, although that's evident that there's a regulatory taking. The problem comes from not from these peripheral governmental actions that affect patent values downstream. The problem comes from working directly on the patent, meaning that the patent right is affected directly as opposed to by some things where the government, for example, doesn't grant approval to put a drug on the market or withdraws approval after it's been granted or things like that. The problem is that, you know, AIA or regulations enacted pursuant to it target the patent specifically. So it's as if the government doesn't just build DMV down the street and thus increasing traffic on my street, it builds a DMV in part on my property. That's how I view it. And then the only other second point that I would like to make, and I would certainly be happy to return to others during the Q&A session, is that about the PATLEX decision. Camilla is absolutely right. This had a similar issue had, in fact, been litigated in the Federal Circuit, and Judge Newman did, in fact, write an opinion rejecting a constitutional challenge to the old ex-party re-exam provision, which was back then was new in the 1980s. Rina Monta and my co-author Rina Monta and I would do discuss that in the paper, but I don't think that's analogous. And Judge Newman has written a stinging dissent from a recent Federal Circuit decision trying to rely on PATLEX. And the difference is fundamental and twofold. First, the 1980s proceedings was an ex parte proceedings. It was a re-exam where you kind of started from scratch, but the benefit of it was that you could amend your claims to escape any challenge of invalidity, and you could amend them liberally and for as long as you like. You could go multiple rounds until you finally got, so you still maintained your property. In these new proceedings, because they're judicial as opposed to or quasi-judicial as opposed to the examination type proceedings, you don't really have the same way to amend. And the statistics bear it out. I think over the last, we're now what, almost 4 years in, I think about five, maybe six motions to amend have been granted, and some of them have been unopposed, and that's the only reason they've been granted. And so that really, there's no kind of trade-off where the patents are re-examined in the old system, on one hand re-examined under a broader standard, but on the other hand, you have a chance to amend. Now that there is no real chance to amend, there's one on paper, but there's not one in effect. And then, of course, the second difference is that the old proceedings were, in fact, ex parte, where there was not a opposing party doing it, trying to challenge you every step of the way. And these proceedings are quasi-judicial, and they are inter-parties. And I think so Judge Newman's dissent in the denial of en banc and COSO really brings those differences to the fore.
All right. Thank you, Greg. I have one question for you, and then I'd like to give Camilla and Ben a chance to respond in any way they would like to, and then we'd like to open up for questions from the listeners. Greg, I wonder, in trying to get to the solution here on the takings question, if the framing of this or what kind of metaphor we choose to use to describe what's going on is going to be kind of decisive. And what I mean by that is it seems to me that if one starts from the position of saying a patent has been granted, and at that point that's kind of like being granted a deed or something like that, and one has an idea that these kind of the meets and bounds are set, and then if there's this IPR procedure where some of the claims are invalidated, so some of the property that was given is taken away, that seems like a very strong case for, you know, the kind of regulatory taking. On the other hand, if one starts from the position of saying patents are granted by the Patent and Trademark Office, but they're only valid insofar as they are novel and non-obvious, and at any point in court, obviously people can come forward and prove that the Patent Office made a mistake, then if one starts from that point of view and doesn't think you've been granted something that's been taken, but rather this is a error correction procedure, will it be a court or the Supreme Court, if it were to go to the Supreme Court, kind of making that decision on their starting presumptions that will decide it, or are there other factors that go into it?
So I think it's an excellent question, but ultimately I don't think it matters, I guess, and only in the following sense. I mean, certainly if you take the view that patents are really nothing except, and there are some scholars that certainly take this view, that patents are merely a right to sue, and whether or not you actually have any substantive rights really will depend on how the adjudicative process will go. So if you start with that view, then really nothing has changed whether you do administrative process, whether you do broader reasonable construction, or whatever else, because you still have a right to sue. And in fact, you are kind of suing, or at least you're responding to this quasi-lawsuit, and, you know, we're adjudicating your rights, and that's all fine. But if you take the view that patents actually have some sort of substantive rights, now, possibly granted an error, but that's true about any property, right? So I could get a land from a government that they realize that really the deed they gave to me was actually described twice, you know, put a borderline somewhere in an incorrect place. And they can go and prove it and so show that there was a mistake of understanding, not meeting of the minds, and all that other good stuff that we learn in law school. And if they carry their burden, at least part of my deed or all of my deed may be invalidated. And that's fine. You know, that's fine. So I think it really depends on how you view patents. Do you view them as substantive rights, which I think is the more correct way of viewing them, or do you view them merely as a right to sue? And if you view them as the substantive rights, then the mere fact that they could be invalidated, which has been true from the founding of the Republic, I don't think really changes the analysis. Here's the final point I want to make. I don't actually mind on a constitutional grounds. I may mind them on various empirical and economic grounds. But I don't mind on a constitutional grounds a system where we're saying, look, every patent going forward as of, what is today, July 13th, 2016, will be subject to the following rules. If it gets litigated in federal courts, you have this sort of system. If you get litigated in back in the PTO, it has that system. And if it gets litigated somewhere else, it has the other system. And you know before you get a patent that you may be subject to this myriad of rules, and that you may be subject to all sorts of methods of invalidation. And before you get this right, you know going forward, if you don't like it, you don't take this right. That's fine as a constitutional matter. Again, not sure if it's good as a policy matter, but that aside, my problem is that with retroactive application of the AIA to the patents that were already issued, where you've already negotiated for your right, you thought you were getting one thing, and it turns out you're getting a different thing.
Can you go back to the real property analogy? I'm curious. So say you have a system in which people can get deeds to property, and the government realizes that the system is granting a lot of those deeds in error just because of the way it's being run. If the government then said all of a sudden, look, we're introducing a new way to review deeds to make sure that they are accurate, would that, under your reasoning, constitute a taking versus this sort of curative to improve the system?
Well, I don't think improvements in a system will necessarily – I don't think improvements in a system, even if they result in a higher rate of invalidation, are necessarily a taking. So, for example, imagine a situation where a government said, look, we are going to create a new federal circuit where, by law, every person who is appointed to the bench must have a PhD in some sort of science, and we must have 3 computer science PhDs and 5, you know, chemistry and whatever else. And only those judges with relevant PhD may sit on a panel affecting a relevant patent. Now, that may result in some sort of more strict application of various rules because those judges will be experts not just in law but in relevant science. And that may result in more patent invalidation because judges kind of know what to look for, more so than perhaps more lay judges. That, I think, is fine. I think my concern is not that there's more invalidations as such. You know, that sort of – No, it's more of a changing of the rules of the game.
Yeah,
changing of what those words actually mean.
I think there's a lot of pins and needles line drawing here. I mean, Judge Newman's change in approach is interesting. And I mean, the way I see the earlier re-exam is, I mean, there's a great piece by Polk Wagner a while ago, sort of laying out the different ways to review patents and make sure they're providently granted. First, you get that PTO examination stage. Then you get the option for post-grant challenge, and then you get the option to challenge in litigation. And the 1980 examination procedure, I mean, it certainly did resemble that early examination stage. And I think, you know, we tried that, and now I think there's a sort of a shift to more relying less on litigation and less on initial PTO review and more on this sort of what may be a sweet spot of post-grant review. And, you know, is that – I think that may be – I think a lot of the reluctance may be to this idea of having a trial-like system run by an administrative agency. And I think that really gets to the Article 3 and Seventh Amendment issues more than anything else. I'm just not sure we can draw lines with broadest reason.
Well, I think that we can. And again, as a policy matter, I'm not sure that IPRs. Post-grant reviews are somewhat of a different animal, and I'm happy to go into why, but I just want to focus on IPR for now. I have doubts that as a policy matter.
I'm sorry, Greg. This is a very interesting discussion. I just want to make sure we have enough time.
Absolutely. I'm happy to yield the floor.
Okay. So Ben, unless if there's something you wanted to say briefly, didn't want to leave you out, but you could chime in. Otherwise, maybe in taking questions. Ben?
Yeah, I mean, one brief comment, which is that I have the same line drawing worry that Camilla has, which is that, I mean, certainly you can distinguish ex parte reexamination, which was that issue in Catholic, from inter partes review. But if you look at Quozo, which is the Supreme Court's most recent decision, it seemed unwilling to make the kinds of distinctions between different kinds of availability for amendment that a Fifth Amendment challenge would rely on, or at least the kind that Arena and Greg make in this particular case.
Okay, thank you. And now, Tim, if you would like to open up questions that we might have in the queue.
Sure. We're now going to open the floor to questions. In a moment, we're all going to hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key on your telephone, and we will address questions in the order in which they are received. Again, if you have a question that you'd like to ask our panel, hit star and then the pound key on your telephone. The lines are wide open. You'll jump right to the front of the queue. As soon as you hit star and the pound key, David, I'll go ahead and just turn it back over to you if see if there's anything anyone else wants to say while we get some questions queuing up here.
Great, and then just let us know if when that happens. All right, so Greg, I did kind of cut you off earlier, and Ben has made an additional point here, so I don't know if you wanted to...
Sure. Again, I'm going to try to be brief. I think so. The line-drawing issue is easy for me, again, as a constitutional matter. I don't want to give the impression that I like the system at all as a practical matter, but as a constitutional matter, I think it's a fundamental difference between applying this new system, and maybe Camilla is right. I think we disagree, you know, again, on policy, but maybe she's right, and I'm willing to grant for the sake of argument that she's right that IPRs are a sweet spot for review, that we finally found this not too expensive system, something that's better at weeding out bad patents, fine. And I'm happy to, you know, if that's actually empirically true, I'm happy to have this new system in place for patents issued after the system was adopted, not for patents that were negotiated, obtained, was under certain a different understanding of what the rules of the game are. And, you know, and the problem will resolve itself in 20-odd years because the patents don't last forever. They last only for 20 years. With respect to Ben's point, I understand the Supreme Court decided Quozo, but they didn't address the Fifth Amendment issue, even though I, along with a number of other professors, filed a brief on this matter. I think they should get better clerks who would read my briefs and then cite them. But, you know, I respect the Supreme Court. I respect their role in our judiciary. That doesn't necessarily mean I always agree with what they do, especially lately in the patent area. So even if they were to disagree with my and Arena's view on the Fifth Amendment here, you know, that's just a legitimate disagreement between us and them.
Fair enough.
All right, we do have an audience question on the line, so we're going to go right to the first caller.
Yes.
Go ahead, caller.
Good afternoon. Yes, good afternoon. Joseph is asking your partners. Just wanted to briefly ask Camelia, obviously with IP and patent law, what do you think analogous going forward to as patent trolls? A couple of years ago, we had actually served with a patent regarding copyright, or actually copying, scanning documents into our scanner and copying those. I think maybe some people are familiar with that. And they had thought that we were actually a law firm, Sidley Austin, which is also in the same building, but they actually came after us because of that. But, the patents, there's clearly a patent troll coming after us as well as thousands of other, companies. Just want to get your thoughts and opinion on that.
Sorry, did you say that you thought that you were being sued by a patent troll?
Yeah, we were. Yeah, they sued thousands of companies. Basically, they alleged that they had a patent on scanning documents in and sending them via email. They, Xerox obviously got involved into the patent litigation as a respondent, but before that they were going after individual companies. Some people obviously settled with them. A lot of people didn't, but...
So I'm assuming you're wondering what your sort of legal remedies are in that situation?
Or... Yes, exactly.
Okay, well...
And maybe, I guess how this new law and new what we're discussing here is going to possibly affect patent trolls. And
that's a good question. So, that's kind of what a lot of this is about, is the concern over patent trolls. And so what we were discussing, these new IPR, post-issuance review proceedings, is one option. You can go and challenge a patent that someone is asserting against you in a new administrative proceeding, and it'll likely be cheaper than going to court to challenge that patent. There's also some new state laws being passed, so depending on which state you're in, you may be able to have a private right of action to sue in state court and argue that this patent assertion claim isn't made in bad faith. But to be fair, it's a somewhat high burden. You have to show that there's absolutely no realistic chance that the patent holder can prevail against you. So it depends on the underlying strength of their claim. As I said, patent holders may object to a lot of these new solutions, and you can certainly see why, because if you're a PAE and your business model is based on suing people on patents, once new regulations are in place that give targets new options, this is going to reduce the value of your patents. And so I think that's kind of the subject here, is to what extent are these new options fair to the patentees. But you're voicing the upside, certainly.
Yes, certainly. And I forget the exact case, but it was about 5 years ago. It was a patent troll, and they're suing companies across the United States for the patent office granted them a patent in like 1980 or 90 that said scanning and sending documents to lawyers, and medical professionals, everything do on a daily basis. That's kind of that.
Well, Greg, what did you think?
Your comment.
I think Greg might have some thoughts on this.
I don't really have anything profound to say. I mean, look, in patent world, just like in every other business or human endeavor, there are bad actors, and I'm sure some of the patent holders are bad actors, and they assert patents that they know, or at least should know, are invalid. They assert them against people who they know, or at least should know, don't infringe. And that's bad. And those people should be, and Supreme Court actually just recently made it easier, those people should be hit with attorney fees and possibly other, exceptional awards. And that's fine. But merely because there are bad people out there, they're just like, again, in a real property world, merely because there are people who, build houses in violation of codes or, invade their neighbor's land or, create unhealthy conditions on their land, is not a license, I don't think, for the government to change the rules of land ownership for people who already have vested rights.
This is David. I have a follow-up question for Greg, but Camilla, I didn't mean to cut you off. But I also want to just, Tim, if there are more calls that you want to get in here, please also jump in.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, let me just remind our callers, if you want the floor, go ahead and enter star and then the pound key on your phone.
And Camilla?
Did you have a question?
I do. Okay, fine. I just didn't want to cut you off.
Yep.
Yeah, so Greg, in making an argument, of course, to a court or to the Supreme Court, one of the things a litigator often wants to do is assure the court that this precedent won't run wild through the law and cause lots of disruption. So I'm curious, picking up on the points that both Camilla and Ben made, about how you would present that to a court, or whether you think this approach that you're taking to, or this interpretation that this is a takings in the case of IPR in patent law, would that have widespread effects likely in other areas where we have grants from the government of either grants of rights or privileges, or maybe you'd say recognitions of property rights? Then when you have a procedural change, it would become a takings.
Very good question. And I'll lay my cards on the table, and I'll just admit that I am not losing much sleep over the possibility that property rights, whether intellectual ones or real property rights or personal property rights, are going to be taken more seriously by the government, and that more governmental action will be subject to takings and or sort of due process analysis. That doesn't actually bother me. From my perspective, that's a good thing. That having been said, Supreme Court might be more skeptical about it. And so to the extent that even if they were to adopt my argument, they would want to sort of cabinet. I get that. And I think so one line drawn is the sort of the past versus future. I think what doing this in the future is fine. And the other argument is that this is not about tangential effect on property. This is not about something that, different rules in a slightly different area or rulings in a slightly different area that affect property. But this about governmental action directly with respect to property. And I think that attenuation boundary is also very important to my argument. Certainly will take Camilla's point, as I've said before, that not every government action that affects the value of property is a taking. I think that would be a somewhat silly position to take. So it's about attenuation, and sometimes, it's maybe hard to define, so it's more of a I know it when I see it, and it's about past versus present, versus future.
I thought that was really one of the deeply interesting things about your paper, is that you did find this. I mean, there's a reason that there's all these analogies to patents. There's a reason the Supreme Court cites James, over 100 years later and uses this patent analogy in the takings context, because patents are certainly historically and still somewhat today, we think of them in the same way as we think of other forms of property, sort of like, you've got the specification, the deed. And so surely if you're actually altering the scope, this does resemble some more realistically a taking. And actually, I was curious, we didn't get you to hear your thoughts on judicial actions. Because I think that a case like Alice certainly seems to alter the scope of the right with respect to, say, a software patent.
So, with a case like Alice, obviously we have to engage in some sort of judicial fiction. And once again, cards on the table, I think Alice was wrongly decided, as was Mayo. But that aside, I mean, it is decided. I think the fundamental difference presents itself in the judicial fiction. Supreme Court doesn't make the law. It interprets the law as it always has been. So it interprets what 101 has always meant, and that the Federal Circuit has screwed up. And so in that sense, I don't think there's a practical effect. I think you're right. It's different. So what we used to think was patentable perhaps no longer is. But the way we operate in this country is that, when the Supreme Court makes constitutional pronouncements about right to marriage or the right to be free you know, from having your confession admitted because of you weren't notified of your right to remain silent, they kind of view it, or we as our legal regime, we view it as a right that's always been there. It just has not been clearly enunciated, and so we have to live by them. So, but that's what the Constitution has always meant. So that's kind of where I would, that's how I would respond to that.
Do you see a difference between, say, Congress writing the rules on which patents are granted? So, for example, saying under Section 101, these kinds of patents are patentable. Under Section 112, here's the specification. And say then the PTO, with its, you know, rulemaking authority, then writing its own rules, say broadest reasonable construction. Do you think that 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 is a distinction we can draw in terms of argument?
For me, I don't think. Again, so for me, I don't think so. I don't think that's a particularly useful distinction. I mean, it's all the government. And again, if the PTO used these. You use these rules, again, the Supreme Court disagrees. I'm not sure that they're consistent with congressional intent, and that's why there's a number of bills pending to bring PTO back to have them evaluate claims on the same basis as the Article III courts do. But again, so that's an APA issue, not super interested about it, at least right now, especially when the Supreme Court has spoken. But whether Congress changes rules retroactively or whether administration changes rules retroactively, I don't think it makes a lot of a difference.
Let me try to sum up or maybe get to the heart of part of what is interesting and particularly tricky and difficult about this from a takings perspective. And here's my question. So to some extent, if we're talking about there is, you have a right to a deed if you fulfill certain steps, or you have a right to an entitlement, a government entitlement, if you qualify. If procedures were put in place to make sure that the qualifications were actually there, so think of a railroad worker who qualifies for disability payments. If some new procedure were put in place to make sure that someone were actually disabled, I don't think any of us would call that a taking, even though entitlements have been determined to be property rights. On the other hand, and so that seems somewhat what's going on, but the interesting fact is that, on the other hand, there's also this broadest reasonable interpretation. So it's kind of that the Patent Trial and Appeal Board can kind of stretch the boundaries of what the patent might cover or give it the broadest reasonable interpretation. And in that way, it seems that we're doing more than just saying, you know, do you hit the boxes or not? And I wonder if that's the difficulty as to we're having with trying to say, is this takings or not, this kind of hybrid of the system?
I don't know if this is directed to me or to Camilla, but I think for me that really is the problem. Like I said, if Congress decided to create a new system where, you know, because of the very complex nature of patents, the juries have to be all, you know, have to have at least a bachelor's degree in engineering or related science, that would be a bit odd and may raise other constitutional problems on Article 7 issue, maybe. But I think that would be fine. This is a change in the procedure without affecting the substantive patent rights or its meets and bounds. But the change in the actual meets and bounds, especially, again, to emphasize, concomitant with the change of the burden of proof, I think that is retroactive. I think that's what's problematic for me.
Miller or Ben?
Yeah, I think I'd just like to mention that it's difficult when you start trying to characterize certain issues as substantive versus procedural. And you've seen the way this in the way that the Federal Circuit has handled the PTO's supposedly procedural rulemaking authority over the years. And so I would worry that if that were the line that you were to try to draw between what was permissible and impermissible under the Fifth Amendment, then depending on how you characterize certain things as procedural, like perhaps the broadest reasonable construction standard, you might not cabin what Congress can do or what the PTO can do as effectively as you might, you know, if you were to adopt some kind of stronger statement of what would be impermissible.
See that we have less than 1 minute left for our teleforum. So At this point, I think what it makes sense to do is to thank very much our panelists on a very interesting discussion. Again, we had the benefit of hearing from Professor Greg Dolan at the University of Baltimore School of Law, Professor Camilla Hurdy, who will be starting at the University of Akron School of Law in the fall, Ben Picozzi, a fellow at the Information Society Project at Yale Law School. So thanks all for your participation. I'm David Olson from Boston College Law School, and I will now turn it over to Tim for any final comments.
Thanks all very much for listening and for a great program. One programming note, tune in, call in tomorrow, Thursday, July 14th at 3 o'clock for our next scheduled telephone conference call on property rights in the sharing economy. So until then, thanks once again to our contributors, and we are adjourned.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.